Welcome. This morning, as we gather together to continue our conversation around the book of Ruth, and again, welcome to those of you who are with us for the first time today. We'll try to catch you up a little bit to the conversation where we are at, and invite everyone to join in. We've had a great time the last couple of days, mostly because the wisdom is already in the room, and as folks are willing to share their reflections and their insight of what they hear in the text, it really enlightens our conversation and enriches us all. My name is David Vasquez. I'm one of the campus pastors at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And I'm enamored with story in general, but biblical stories really, to me, are just a lot of fun. Sometimes I think one of the hardest things for our faith communities is, you know, that we forget to have fun with the biblical text. So as we have been doing already this week, and for those of you coming in here, just know that these texts are funny, okay? So they are funny. They are intended to be funny. They are great stories, but they are not only funny. They are funny in the best of funny, which is that it really invites us into deeper thinking, into some challenging conversations as well. So it runs the gamut of emotions, and I hope that we can create, again, the space for that in our conversations today. So we've looked at the first two chapters, or made our way through parts of the first two chapters of Ruth, and we'll continue to do that today. And basically, we'll do a little catching up, and then we'll go back to the text and basically read our way through it a little bit at a time, and then just stop and see what we notice in them. One of the things that I mentioned from the beginning of our conversation that I tried to bring into the conversation, and that it has helped us to think perhaps anew for some of us about this text, is to look at it through the lens of migration. We talked earlier on Monday that if you think about most biblical stories, they involve, if you were to list your favorite Bible stories, many of them involve elements of migration. And so that's, something happens when we are on the move that perhaps opens us up to the divine. And so many of the stories we record, the stories that mark our days, are ones that have happened in times of transition. Yesterday, we talked a little bit about the things that have shaped our lives. If you were to go to your high school reunion, how would you introduce yourself? What are the markers that would sort of indicate what your life has been like since you left high school, and if you're going back for 5, 10, 15, 30, 50 years, high school reunion? So part of what happens also is that many of those marking points are transitions, the ones we've made successfully. We sometimes have a hard time, certainly at a high school reunion, talking about the things that have been difficult, the transitions we haven't done so well with. Yet the biblical story invites us to name very clearly, very loudly sometimes, the places of grief and sorrow. The story in the book of Ruth could also be called the story of Naomi. She is one of the main characters in the story. And a brief recap, she and her family are forced to migrate or choose to migrate because of a time of famine and also a time of political distress in the land. And so they go into enemy territory out into Moab. In Moab, they have a terrible time. The husband dies, the two sons die. They had married women in Moab. And then they return to Bethlehem. And that's where we spent some time yesterday as she returned and thought about the experience that this part of the work that I've done on biblical texts has been to take the opportunity to read these texts with people who live with a greater awareness of their migration, particularly undocumented workers in the United States. And many of them heard in the story, versions of their own story in the story of Ruth. Many elements of it resonated for them. Certainly, that experience of Naomi, when she comes back and she says some very powerful words, "I went away full and I have come back empty. Call me no longer Naomi," she says, which meant pleasant, "but call me Mara," which means bitter, "because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me." And many of these folks related those words to their experience if they had been deported or they had loved ones who had been deported, who took the chance or out of desperation migrated and then were forced to return and felt that they had returned having lost more than they gained by their transition. And so we have been both at some really fun places in the story and some also very difficult points in the story. So we'll begin with a word of prayer and kind of do a little bit more catching up and then get into the text. So you can pray.
Good and gracious God, God of all people, God of surprises, Open our eyes this day to notice all that is hidden and unexpected in this world. Help us to see gifts where we might be tempted to feel scorn. Help us to see opportunity and risk. Help us to see others as you would have them seen. All this we ask in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Amen.
Let's start out just kind of recapping a little bit more. So what are other things outside of the kind of brief recap I have done that you would like us to kind of carry with us, or what has stayed with you in the, from the last couple of days of conversation, for those of you who have been able to be a part of it already? We just want to shout out some things that have stayed with you.
Significance of names.
Names, yeah. We talked a lot about the variety of names in the story are quite significant. I've already mentioned Naomi, you know, wanting to be called Mara, but similarly with the other characters in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in many ways, this foreigner, we talked in our first session that part of the context of this book is that it happens at a time of high xenophobia, would be a term we would use today, may have been a different term, or may not have existed as a term then, but basically, the people of Israel had been in exile as they returned. There was a period of sort of purification, there was an anxiety as they returned, particularly about those who had stayed in the land and had intermarried with other cultures, perhaps even with those who came to control the land. And so there, you know, some of that period went to the extent that the law became a requirement to divorce foreign wives. That was the common terminology used, and there are references to that both in the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. So many scholars believe that the book of Ruth, even though it's set in the time of the judges much earlier, that it was likely written or took shape most fully, or became an important reading anyway, as a counter voice to that xenophobia period in the land, to provide an alternative, that a foreigner could actually be a contribution to the land.
Mm-hmm. And we've got the interesting situation. A fellow named, Jewish lay scholar named Dov Krulovich wrote a book called Harry Potter and Torah, which, unlike the book called Harry Potter and the Bible, is not anti-Harry Potter per se, but it shows how concepts in Torah are connected with our Harry Potter. And remember, in Harry Potter, for those of you who've read it, there's this concept of mudbloods, people who are half from, quote, muggle, which means the rest of us, and half from wizard blood. And so there's a chapter in Krulovich's book, Does God Approve of Mudbloods? Guess what? God approved of mudbloods, and he uses the story of Ruth and the story of other, and also the story of the fact that the other side of the line of King David came from what was basically an inappropriate relationship between Judah and his daughter, Yehuda, you know, one of Jacob's sons, and his daughter-in-law, I forget her name, but
Tamar,
who had set herself up as a prostitute alongside the
And that story is hugely significant to the chapter we will see today. So we'll transition to today's chapter a little bit. We'll finish off part of chapter 2 and then go into chapter 3. So we're going to be straddling a couple different parts of the story. But as we begin, what we want to do next, actually, real quick, is the village on this Freedom Day, you know, 4th of July, is wrestling with something. They want to show a movie that is appropriate for family. So it is your task to figure out what is an appropriate movie to watch for the whole community. What is a family movie? So you are becoming, you know, the village's, well, this is all fictitious, but let's pretend, okay? Anyway, you are becoming, you know, we're celebrating freedom yet. As a country of freedoms, we set certain boundaries for ourselves. So let's figure out what's appropriate. So if we were to show a movie tonight, a family movie, so what I want you to do in, you know, pairs or small groups quickly is list movies that you think would not be appropriate for the family movie tonight. You'll have to confess that you've seen them, right? And then, more importantly, come up with 2 to 3 things that, you know, categories or you know, whatever you want to call it, 2 to 3 criteria you would want to use for you, you know, for the Holden Village family movie rating system, okay? So take a moment with each other. All right, so seems like we have a very engaged board of supervisors, whatever we want to call ourselves. So what are some of the criteria you have come up with?
Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yankee Doodle Dandy will be the movie we can watch.
What criteria?
So either names of movies that you think would be appropriate, but most importantly, what would be some criteria for selecting an appropriate movie, that would be family appropriate?
G.
Okay. But what's the criteria? So no, somebody has to decide what G means.
Animals.
Okay. Has to have animals.
No bad language.
No bad language. Okay.
No violence. If evil is depicted and it's recognizable as evil.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a way to overcome it.
Ah, okay. All right.
So it has to have a moral to the story.
All right. So we wanted to have a point. All right. Not just violence and frills for the sake of it.
Sound of music, be pretty safe.
All right. Sound of music. There are animals, and there's not. Whatever violence happens involves a guitar.
Cannot annoy the adults too much.
Okay, so there's got to be something in there for the adults. Okay.
101
Dalmatians.
All right. All right. And, we might get into a debate as to whether that one would annoy the adults or not, right?
Well, I came up with movies that don't have animals, and probably just because it was the 4th of July, don't really show the United States in the best light, but do it in a humorous way. And I'm thinking about the two mouse movies, The Mouse That Roared and The Mouse on the Moon.
So part of it is, can the movie have a point, but not necessarily just a moral point, but perhaps a challenging point, something that kind of, becomes a mirror to ourselves. Good stories are difficult to craft, and yet humans have dedicated amazing resources to creating excellent stories. For all of the whining we might do about the decay of our society because children watch too much TV, the reality is that in one way, we today, as a society, dedicate the most resources to storytelling of any period before. I mean, it's amazing the amount of resources that we put to telling stories. They're not always very good stories, but we are certainly fascinated as a society with stories. Much of our technology is dedicated to communicating and to telling stories. As we have, some of us may be given up on books or whatever, there's lots of other ways that storytelling, the printed word, whether it's happening in a digital device or in a book, continue to really encapture much of our imagination. Stories have a significant role in our lives, and we value them hugely. The story of Ruth is certainly an incredibly crafted story. And as we make our way through it, we are seeing only some layers of it. Each of you has read this book maybe before, for those of you who haven't, you know that every time you come to it, something else strikes us in a way that in a good story, whether told orally, written in a book, or presented in a movie, can really engage us. So a fair warning as we go into the next section of the story, that the story has been rated Art Plus, because there are elements in the story that are a little bit too difficult, and sometimes you kind of wonder, was that really necessary? Could we tell the story without that scene? One of the things I did earlier in my parish ministry is I would read the Book of Ruth with confirmation class all the way through. And, for those of you who have the opportunity to work with young adults in the church, especially with youth, I highly recommend just sitting and reading through this book with them. You need to do it with a level of honesty and openness about, it's a bit of a shocking story at elements, but it is really a great way to recognize that there is room in the Bible for conversations about a lot of issues that are complex, that stories at their best help us to think, not only about the things we like to think about, but push some boundaries as well. So let's return to the text with all of that background and expectation. But we're actually going to pick up a little bit of where we left off yesterday. So chapter 2, verse 14 is where we will begin. Narrator 1 will get us started there with Boaz responding, and we'll read just through the end of that section there, through the end of chapter 2. And so chapter 2, verse 14 is where we will begin in the book.
At mealtime, Boaz said to her,
am I still Boaz? But
no, we had someone. You were going to be. Okay, and actually, one second before we. A little background, just to set the scene quickly. What has happened is Naomi has returned to Bethlehem with Ruth. They left in a time of famine. Now it's harvest time. So, yesterday we talked about, the town's abuzz. And as they get back, then Ruth says, let me go out into the fields to glean, which meant she would go behind the reapers and pick up the stuff that was left over, which by law was allowed. And she happens to end up doing this in a town, in the land of Boaz, who notices her out on the field. So, back to Boaz.
Come here and eat some of this bread, and dip your morsel in the sour wine.
Narrator 2 was who?
I'm actually not sure where we are.
Oh, sorry. On the book, right, it's let's see, I don't know. The pages are numbered. Sorry. Right before chapter 3. Right in the middle, if you open it right to the middle.
Oh,
at the top there. Sorry.
Okay. So she sat beside the reapers, and he heaped up for her some parched grain. She ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she got up to glean, Boaz instructed his young men.
Let her glean even among the standing sheaves, and do not reproach her. You must also pull out some handfuls of her from the bundles and leave them for her to glean, and do not rebuke her.
So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She picked it up and came into the town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gleaned. Then she took out and gave her what was left over after she herself had been satisfied. Her mother-in-law said to her,
"Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you."
So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said,
"The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz. Oh, blessed be by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. The man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin.
He even said to me, 'Stay close by my servants until they have finished all my harvest.'
It is better, my daughter, that you go out with his young woman. Otherwise, you might be bothered in another field."
So she stayed close to the young women of Boaz, leaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
Okay. Let's stop there for a minute. So what do you notice in that portion of the text? What stands out to you?
So there's danger for those women out there.
Yeah. The number of times that she is warned about being bothered in another field, about Boaz having to tell his young men not to bother her. She, again, is a foreign woman out in a field, a time of harvest. And so she's running a huge risk by doing this, and yet she has not choice. This is the only option available to her, except for another option that she would have had, which is that of prostitution. And we talked yesterday very briefly about that. We need to keep that in mind, that as a foreign woman who has no family around her, and as someone who has been married and is no longer a virgin, her virginity or her sexuality is her own and not somebody else's, which means she could legitimately become a prostitute as a way to survive. If you think in the stories earlier in the biblical text, certainly of Rahab, you know, the prostitute who helps the spies who come into the land, that was difficult, but a profession, you know, as people will often say, the oldest profession, but it had to do with women who were given very little choices in life. And for her, the choice was either to work out in the field gleaning and that, but then she was still very much at risk of sexual harassment or abuse or exploitation. So this is a reality that hangs throughout the whole story, you know? Anything else that you notice in the text?
There was an about shift in Naomi's attitude, or her, all of a sudden her spirits were raised, you know.
Mm-hmm. Say a little bit more about that. Where do you notice the change, and what do you see change there?
Where she says in verse 20, blessed be he by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. And she came back feeling almost like she was dead, you know, like she was bitter and things. And suddenly she sees sunrise on the horizon.
Yeah. So what's changed?
She has someone, she has hope for the future.
Yeah. And this is embodied in this woman. You know, what's really powerful in the story is that the pinnacle of it often is this dialogue, this oath that Ruth makes to stick with her daughter, with her mother-in-law, even though neither of them has much of a future. What's interesting is that the person of the faith, the one who's part of the tribe, can see a future and becomes quite desolate and has the willingness to express her grief and sorrow. And this foreigner keeps hope and keeps trying. to the point that it begins in this, you know, this is a woman's cooperative that begins to form between it. This is a common theme in the biblical story as well. When you think about the story of the Exodus and all the women who make it possible, the Pharaoh says, you know, kill all the baby boys because the women, why would we worry about them? They're no threat. And what happens in the early story is that the Pharaoh is totally undone by all these women who come together. It is Puah and Shifra, it is Yochebed and Miriam, all of these, the mother, the sister, the brother, all of them come together.
And
all these
finally,
women.
His daughter.
His daughter? Right. It's his own daughter who turns on him and rescues Moses. So that's what is echoed in this. Now think about the way that this story about a foreigner is echoing many of the stories that are the core stories of the people. Mm-hmm. And the foreigner is embodying these values. So here, then, I think someone over here.
Oh, I was going to say, we're starting to answer the question that I brought up yesterday. What is it going to take to restore her faith?
Uh-huh.
You know, and it seems like that's already starting to come back.
Uh-huh.
So she came back with the thought that there's no hope. I mean, whatever is going to happen, we'll see. But Ruth obviously came with, because that was her hope, that she was going to have a better life there with Naomi.
There's a change in agency, is a term that's often used. The ability to feel like you can do something about your life, that you have some ability to influence your own life. And she, you know, desolation is the loss of that sense. The sense that there's nothing I can do anymore. I am empty. And what she begins to feel is that there is possibility of agency.
I wonder how Ruth felt, though, because maybe she would be discriminated against in her hometown, or her among her people, because she had married this Israeli, you know, the
mm-hmm.
person, this Jew from Israel. So maybe she felt safer, in a sense, sticking with Naomi, who loved her and, you know, hoping for the best into the future, and where Naomi was going from bad,
mm-hmm.
Ruth was feeling that maybe, well, there might be hope.
There might be hope for me there.
Yeah.
And that's part of the thing. You know, one of the things that happened, there's a song in Spanish that says, no soy de aquí ni soy de allá, no tengo edad ni por venir. I'm not from here, I'm not from there, I have no age and no future. And the song basically is the story of someone who has migrated and who has this experience of really not knowing where they're from anymore. You know, whenever you've crossed the line, whatever the line is, a gender line, if you cross the line, denominational line, if you cross the line, whatever the line of the sand is, there's a way in which it's difficult to know where you belong now once you've crossed it. Will you be welcomed back in one place? Will you be received and accepted in the other? And these two women feel like they both have crossed certain lines. They've lost certain things. But rather than turning on each other, they come together with each other to find a future. Any other things in the text that stand out to you?
Yeah. It's more like the righteousness of God spelled out in the laws.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, don't harvest everything. Leave something that fringes for somebody who passes by. So like Boaz here is not only doing that, he's going beyond what the law asks him.
Mm-hmm.
Just, okay, give something what you have harvested.
So we're being told a little bit about this character Boaz, right?
Right.
I mean, there may be some questions about him that we might have. We don't know much about him, but at least in this beginning scene, yesterday we were wondering, why did he notice her? I mean, out of all the other workers who were on the field, why did he notice her? Was it what she looked like? Was her clothes? I mean, I don't know. Something attracted him to her. What are his intentions? And we still don't know, but at least he's beginning to look like somebody who at least cares. Or, given that X-rated sort of background, you know, what is this about? Why is he getting all these favors? What would that be like, that the foreigner is getting extra food? What's a common concern about foreigners in the land when they begin to get benefits that the locals don't get? You know, and the assumptions about that. You know, all those tensions are kind of simmering in the story. And certainly for those hearers originally, they'd be a little frustrated by hearing that Boaz is doing this for this foreign woman. Any other things? One part of the story that often reading it with people who have lived through quite a bit of hardship, especially living in a country of undocumented immigrants and who have come out of situations, either refugees and other circumstances, the idea of the image of her eating her full and still having so much to bring back. People have told stories of moments when, for the first time after a long period of time with no food in their lives regularly, not knowing where their next meal will come from, the very first time that they can sit at a table and eat their fill and know that there's still left over and sufficient for another day. That's where the transformation begins to happen in the story. We started out in a time of famine, both in food and in political leadership and authority. And now we're beginning to see a man in power who is fulfilling at least the basis of the law. We don't know his motivation, but going beyond it. So the political possibilities are there. And food is also available, more than what is basically needed. Anything else before we move on to the next section of the text? We'll continue reading on chapter 3 then, the beginning of chapter 3. And again, we have narrator 1 and 2, Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, and we'll read, I'll show you just what to stop as we kind of make our way through it.
Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her,
"My daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. Now here is our kinsman, Boaz, with whose young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do."
Okay, we're going to stop there. We're going to reread that, okay, in case you missed it, all right? Now, let's get a little context, all right? So this is a mother-in-law talking to his, evidently at least somewhat noticeable, attractive, I don't know, daughter-in-law, right? It is the harvest time, so let's just read through that again. And think of, you know, get into character a little bit here. Okay. See what we hear.
"My daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. Now here is our kinsman Boaz, with whom young women you have been working. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now, wash and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do."
Let's just keep going, and we'll come back to it. Now, I tell you, try reading this with your, you know, 7th and 8th graders. It's a lot of fun. Right.
"She said to her,
'All that you tell me, I will do.'"
What an obedient. Go on.
"So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had instructed her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, and he was in a contented mood, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came stealthily and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there, lying at his feet, was a woman. He said..."
Drunken voice? Oh.
Sure, go into it, get into it.
"Who are you?"
"I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin."
"May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. For all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman. But now, though it is true that I am a near kinsman, there is another kinsman more closely related than I. Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will act as next of kin to you, good. Let him do it. If he is not willing to act as next of kin for you, then as the Lord lives, I will act as next of kin to you. Lie down until the morning."
All right, we'll stop there for a bit. So, what did you notice? What stands out to you? A lot of territory coming.
Naomi jumped in to take advantage of a really good situation.
Yeah. What are the choices she has? Is this appropriate? Would this fit our, you know, would we put a warning on this movie? Does it fit propriety? Is it proper? What do you think?
I think it is proper.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
They don't have any other means of livelihood. And she's not married to somebody, she's a widow. So providing for her is Naomi's main intention of suggesting that. Whether that's the right method or not is a different question, but I don't see anything wrong.
You know, one of the things that we try to teach and argue is that, you know, things are black and white, right? There's a law and then you just obey it. There are things that are right and things that are wrong. Now we're starting to say, well, does it depend on the circumstances? Do people whose choices are more limited have different choices than people who have more freedom? Does Boaz, in this situation, have more choices than Ruth or Naomi?
But she has a precedent. Uh-huh. Because of the, what you have up there, the live-right marriage laws, you know, so she does have some sort of precedent. Yeah.
So let's take a little aside here to provide some background in case you're not familiar with a couple of pieces. The first one is the word goel, which is this next of kin, is the way that it's translated here. You know, the phrase in Job, I know that my Redeemer lives, Redeemer. Next of kin, these are the same word goel is translated in a variety of ways. What this is part of is a somewhat complex system of laws, as most of it is found in Deuteronomy 25, so you can take a look at that on your own. But basically, what it boils down to is that when there is a marriage, you know, and the husband dies, then the woman, it is the responsibility of the next of kin. So if the man has brothers, then the next brother is responsible for caring for this woman, for the wife who's now a widow, and should marry her. That's his responsibility to do. And if there isn't a brother, then whoever the next of kin is, and it becomes one of those, you know, Henry III, plays where you're trying to figure out who the next of kin is, and it becomes quite complicated, depending on various relations, which is the bit we get at the end there from Boaz. Well, you know, I'm not exactly the next of kin. Spend the night, though. You know, we'll find out in the morning. Why do you come about it? But anyway, he says there's somebody else before me in the line, to redeem her. Now, it's more complicated than that because it's not just marrying this woman. Whoever marries this woman then also inherits the land that was the man's, but in a tricky way. What happens is the child of their union will actually inherit it. So sometimes for men, this is not convenient, because that child who is born to the union, if there was no child, which is the case here, that child is not considered the second husband's son, but rather the son of the first one, even though it's not biologically that way. Does that make sense? So basically, in a way, you're splitting your inheritance. If you can figure out a way for her to go away and disappear, then you can actually receive the land, purchase it, and not worry about the child and, you know, having to split your inheritance. So it gets very complicated. Most of the hearers of the story would have known all of this, at least in some version of it. For us, we need to kind of return to it. The second thing that's helpful to have in our little aside is, anybody know what the word feet might stand for in the story?
Yes.
Must be stated.
It's never been explained to me on our side, but it sounds like you're implying that it could mean sexual parts.
Exactly. And you know, when King David is out with Saul out in the field, and if you may remember the story when David, actually before he's king, Saul is king at the time, David is the revolutionary out, and he has the opportunity to kill Saul because he finds him relieving himself out in a cave. And the reference is obvious there that, you know, that his feet were exposed when David approaches him. So it is a common
euphemism
for body parts, privates, to use the word feet. So if you keep that in mind and reread the text, you kind of get a sense that this is really quite edgy. It's pushing the boundaries of what may be appropriate. Now, we said this is a levirate marriage, so to some extent there's a right. But the piece that oftentimes that I was really, that some of the readers, when they did this with groups of immigrants, one of the things that one of the people picked up on, she said, what Naomi said was, he will tell you what to do. What happens though? We are told that she did everything that Naomi told her. But did she? She dressed up. She went down. She waited till he was happy and contented, till he lay down or passed out. Snuck up on him, lay by his feet, and then what happens when he wakes up?
He didn't know she was there until.
Yeah, so his startle ended.
I will do what you tell me to do.
Who says that?
Boaz.
So did you notice what's happening here? Who's the one with power in this relationship? And what? But this has shifted, right? I mean, Naomi told Ruth, he will tell you what to do. And instead, it is Ruth who tells him what to do. So they go all the way down to the very edge of where she was supposed to do what her mother-in-law had told her. But then this sense of agency becomes quite significant for this young woman, who's a foreigner, who doesn't have a lot of standing. She knows the law. She knows what the responsibility of being next of kin is. She is the one who brings it up to him. This is breaking so many rules, you know, that she has no way to enforce this request. If she were to be raped and left there, she has no recourse. What would people say?
She's a bad woman.
Yeah?
She asked for it.
What does she look like that night?
A murderer.
Sure.
Sneaking in the night and laying by his feet.
And somebody had mentioned the story of Tamar, you know, and Judah. Read that story at some point, chapter 37 in Genesis, and you will. I mean, that story is totally being played. Because in that story, what happens, it's kind of complicated, but Judah refuses to let one of his sons marry Tamar because his sons have died because of being evil. Of course, Tamar is the one who gets blamed that the husbands are dying. And so he refuses to let his last son marry her and says, oh, just wait, you know, once he's older, I'll bring him over. And he's refusing to do it. And so what Tamar does, she dresses herself as a harlot, as a prostitute, stands by the road, and entices Judah. They end up having a sexual relationship. He denies it, except that she has kept some of his property, which she sends back to him and says, oh, here, whoever this belongs to is the father of my child, basically. So there's precedent for this, and this foreign woman knows it. She's using the same, you know, that she's playing out a core source in their community.
Is there a parallel then to the daughters of Lot and their seduction, if you call it that, of their father?
In what way would you say? I mean, there's certainly, you know, some...
Well, I'm just thinking, they're thinking, you know, we had to leave our home, we had to run. What are our chances? What are our prospects? You know, we won't have a protector, we won't have a husband, we won't have sons and stuff, you know. Dad's three sheets to the wind. Let's do what we need to do.
And so what did they do?
They had intercourse with her father and had babies.
And they got him drunk.
Right.
They got him drunk first. And
yeah,
they had children.
Basically happy.
Okay. Now remember when we started out, who are the Moabites? They are the children of that relationship.
Right.
You know?
And the Ammonites are the upper children.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, all of these stories are incredibly crafted. I mean, they are so, it's just like, you know, Lord of the Rings, all those things, you know. Come on, they're peanuts. Harry Potter, they're peanuts. You want a complicated story with lots of great letters. Anything else that you noticed in the text?
So why
did... Hey, let's go back here and then back to you.
I was thinking how incredibly vulnerable she was and how much Naomi must have either been desperate or trusted Boaz. And then I'm curious, would Boaz have known her? Would he have recognized that, oh yeah, Naomi is my distant cousin. This must be the daughter-in-law. We heard about all those deaths. Would he have known that?
Well, to some extent, he clearly already says, I'm not next of kin. He's been doing his research, you know. So he's thought about it. He noticed her. And now he's trying to find out. I mean, he has been asking around about her. Now, in the book, Boaz and Naomi are never together. I mean, they likely knew each other eventually, but in the book, they're never together. So that's significant. I'm not sure why they're never portrayed together in the story. But there's certainly quite a bit going on here in terms of, you know, what is it that she needs? I mean, oftentimes the place to spend some time is imagining what that night was like for Naomi. I mean, certainly what it was like for Ruth, you know, to go there. And for Naomi to have told her to do this and to be waiting until the next morning. Again, people who live as undocumented immigrants, every day they leave for work, they're taking their lives in their hands in many ways, because when they leave their kids at school, they don't know if they'll see them in the afternoon, because they could be picked up while driving to work and end up in a system that will bounce them around until they're deported. And this is every day. So every morning when they leave work, they know that they're doing things that are not quite appropriate, that are not proper. The questions we need to wrestle with is it right? Is it wrong? What choices do they have? What kind of choices do people without power and on the margins have? And while we need to be a country of laws, there have to be rules, and we have to obey them, how is the exercise of the law done? Certainly, your income is directly related to how much time you'll spend in jail in this nation. You know? And so people who live on the margins, whose income is less, are either more evil or have fewer choices. Those are the things we need to wrestle with, at least. The text challenges us to think, in a society, if we assume that the text is being written and told in a context of extreme kind of like, let's revive the law, this is the way the law ought to be. If we assume that, and we assume that this book is a critique or at least a countervoice to that, what is it inviting us to do? And to the extent that we might find ourselves in a similar period of time in which the enforcement of the law is important and we value it, certainly on a day like today, when we think about our freedom, we should at least wrestle with it.
We have Boaz, it seems to me, anyway, doing that, because early on he said, I've heard how loyal you are to your mother-in-law, Naomi. And he's impressed with that. So he gets down here in verse 10 and he says, this last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. So he's seeing that she's doing good things, so he's going to go to bat for her.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a person in power, and we might think an entity in power that's looking like, you deserve to have somebody go to bat for you. Sort of like, you know what, I don't want to get political here, but I'm going to. Like Obama did when he said the children of immigrants can go to school and get this two-year, you know, waiver and so forth. And there has to be some sort of, somebody has to go to bat.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems he's doing this.
Yeah. And we should get political. I mean, whether we do that in our conversation here or individual conversations, we should get political in the sense, not necessarily a partisan, but political in the sense that these are political decisions that as nations we should make. These are things, do our laws reflect our convictions and values? Do they leave enough room? Is there enough left in the field after we have harvested it for the poor to survive? I mean, these are questions that are political questions, in the best possible sense of political, as much as we use it as a very negative term.
So is Boaz trying to be proper? Is he trying to be appropriate and follow the law? Is that what he's offering? Well, I'm not the next kinsman, but hey, if he's not, I will be, you know.
I mean, that's the thing. The tension is there, right? We don't know.
Does he really want that? He's just trying, well, I'll be the donor. I'll let him see if he wants you. Yeah, not, yeah. I certainly will.
Yeah.
But.
For those of you who may be reading through the story for the first time, you have the advantage of not knowing what happens in the end, right? Of course, it's the Bible, so we want it to end nicely. You know, we want it all to wrap up in the end, even if it gets messy in the middle.
Well, the Bible doesn't always wrap up.
Doesn't always wrap up nicely.
On your side of it, somebody, the great hero gets basically executed, and
mm-hmm.
but he comes back. That is on your side of it. And
mm-hmm.
on our side of it, other things happen that are not so nice. Like Samson gets defeated in the end of, although he brings down the house. You all know that he was the best actor in the world because he brought the house down.
but you're right in that fact, you know, we were reminded on this message last night in the sermon that, you know, at the end of the parable we hear, but all that good old wine, right? I mean, we think we know how it ends, but then there's always, in the biblical story, if we feel that we got it and we understand it, then we probably haven't quite gotten it yet, you know, because it will keep kind of pushing us. Other things that you notice here in the text.
I'm just curious about what the other women in the field are thinking about this. You know, are they thinking, this is the way to make it in this world, or is it going to be socially acceptable once you see it through the lens of, oh, next to kin, it's all right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, clearly we got to hear the story of what happened that night. I mean, it's been a few years. So evidently this has marked Ruth for life. You know? What was she looked at by others? Was she ever really, truly accepted? You know? I mean, in some ways, we get the whole story about her becoming the grandmother of, you know, King David and all that. So you could say she's the immigrant who makes it. But was she ever really fully accepted? What do you think the other women in, you know, thought about her out in the field? One of the groups of women that I read this text with, you know, their image that they had in mind for this scene at the threshing floor was actually a truck stop, a large truck stop out in the field, I mean, out in the middle of, you know, a large deserted area. And what happens oftentimes in some of those areas, that the experience for some of them had been that as you're traveling across the country, or you are at a migrant camp and it's night, they are often divided between where the men are and where the women are. And for a woman to go over there, you know, oftentimes is viewed as only one purpose. The level of risk, you know, that you reminded us of again, that Ruth is taking, even in the middle of the comedy of this. The reality is that this is a very painful story, a very difficult story, and an incredibly risky story. She has no idea what Boaz will do. Her courage to say, for him, you know, when he says, I'll do whatever you tell me, or for her to say what to do, it takes a lot of courage, but she has no way to enforce it. Even with the next of kin law, you know, there's really, again, he's not even the one. Somebody else would. And if this is found out, that she's already spent the night with him, we're not sure what happened, but she spent the whole night. You know, they may just have been right next to each other. Who knows? We're not told what happened, but it doesn't really matter. She was there the whole night. Any other?
I guess I'm impressed by, I was impressed by Ruth's faith, but I even think of that relationship between Ruth and Naomi, and, you know, knowing more about the risks that she's taking. You know, gosh, would you look at Naomi and go, you really want me to do this? You know, it's just asking so much.
Wow.
It's just an ugly thought. You know,
yeah. So if you try to imagine in really this reality, if I were to ask this for someone else in my family,
yeah.
I mean, you know, one of the things, again, that for immigrant families, a comment that they often live with is, how could you do this to your children? You know, leave them behind in another country or cross, you know, a difficult border with them. How could you do this to them? Context matters. What options do we have? How do we view the world? What are the agency that we feel? One phrase I want to make sure we pick up on before we move on to the next section, and read the rest of the text here as we wrap up. We talked about, you know, the levirate marriage, but I want to point you back to one phrase that's used in the text where Ruth says in a verse that's here. Boaz says, who are you? And then Ruth responds, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin. The word cloak is the same word in Hebrew that was used earlier for may God's wings be spread over you. And at that point, earlier on in that encounter, Ruth had said to Boaz, may I find favor in your son. And so Naomi is the one who sends her out. But there's some sense here that Ruth also is not without agency. That she too, that this is more of a partnership between Naomi and Ruth about what they will do and how they will advance. The kind of power they have, this is a really tricky thing, because in many ways they are using sexual power, so to speak, to accomplish a goal. That's really troubling, you know, to have people that's where they are. So she's not prostituting herself necessarily, but there's also this struggle to figure out What does she do? What power does she have? How will this be viewed? So this is not a simplistic story. It acknowledges the kinds of difficult choices that she has to make. Other things that kind of...
Could Naomi have had some conversation and arrangement with Boaz?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's all possible, you know? Except
he acted surprised.
Exactly.
That's not written here.
It's not in there. Exactly. I mean, that's the difficulty. We are clearly not sure, you know, that she has this plan, but we don't know. There's not a lot of time, you know. She just came, and then immediately, it's almost like it looks like on the spur of the moment, and he says, hey, you know, they're going to be out on the threshing floor tonight. By the way, anybody know what a threshing floor is, more or less? Basically, you pick the grain, bring it out. There was this big, you know what, all the piles of grain are there. They actually literally beat it and then kind of throw it up in the air, you know, the winnowing fork kind of idea. And it all, you know, the chaff flies away and then the grain comes down. And that it was hard work. And they would do this 24/7, basically, kind of run quite a bit. There was lots of celebrating, lots of drinking. That's where the whole community, the men were out in the field doing this. And so the women who went out there was a little different. But that's, so they were out in the threshing floor, again, a place filled with men, many of them drunk, and this is what she's doing.
Right? Huh? A male thing, a man thing, you might say.
Yeah. Right, back here.
After many years of reading this, it just dawned on me with your conversation of context. For women of that era, sexuality was their only form of currency. And I'm thinking currency, you know, whatever form is your only, sadly, power, often. And think of today when a woman stays in an abusive marriage because she has no money, no way to get out, no way to get away. She has no currency. So now, as uncomfortable that we women in the room might feel, it's just dawning on me how that is such a different culture and how maybe the women in the field looked at it differently because maybe they understood that's our currency.
Mm. So there may be some of the other women that kind of thought, okay. Now, of course, she's going for the top guy, you know? And that may create other kinds of tension, you know? But you're right. I mean, and this is an ongoing issue. You know, we continue to discuss the role of sexuality for women's place and position in the workforce. I mean, this is not a result of...
Through the ceiling, the glass ceiling, whatever it is, to finally be CIOs of CEOs of companies and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, they go for the top in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how are they viewed because of that? What kind of assumptions are made about the kinds of sacrifices or compromises that they have made to reach those places of power?
Well, women, you know, often say they're called a bitch and men are called clever and whatever to get to that point.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of these things are addressing issues that we have very clearly. So back here first.
The instruction to Ruth is to watch and to anoint. I wonder what our understanding of that anointing is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, most likely, we probably would read lots of things into it. I think in this case, it's probably, I mean, it's always later. Right? In general, it was a common practice. That's how you gazzied up, basically. You know, this is whatever bill between or whatever you're going to put in the equipment. But, you know, it's just dressing up, and oil is used as a way of, you know, what you did. It is certainly connects in many ways to the woman that comes to Jesus and empties an expensive jar of oil at his feet. You know, I mean, that, it's again a story that
happened to be Mary of Magdalene.
Yeah.
Magdalene, but anyway, what I was going to say, if I'm on now, is with another thing that the story can be compared to is you've got a workplace, you've got people who have been working there for years and never been promoted for some reason, and all of a sudden this person, and I'm thinking not so much of, you could add to the tension here by making it a woman, or this person comes in and quickly gets promoted to second in command, and people are beginning to, and everybody else is beginning to say, how did that person do it? And now they say, if it was a woman, who was she sleeping with?
I mean, you know, this is very, very layered, very difficult. We had somebody back here and here, and actually we'll come back to the reading tomorrow and pick up where we left off. So we'll just have a couple of final comments, one here, and then we'll
conclude. I was just going to say our translation said perfume.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. And, you know, anointing basically is a reference to oil, which often, of course, where's our chemist, Brian, here? You know, oil, I'm assuming it's a good base for perfume.
There you go.
All right.
So I was wondering if
Ruth did not take the initiative. So it's almost like she was waiting for somebody's permission to say, it's okay for you to do it.
Yeah.
So the mother-in-law says, Naomi almost kind of
What was that? So she gets back, she's got all the food, she gives it very obediently, you know, she's had her fill, and now she brings all this food back to Naomi. What's the conversation like? What's Naomi thinking? What's Ruth thinking? At what point do you say, hey, I got an idea? You know, the level of trust and relationship between them was incredible. The power of a cooperative, you know? So I want to wrap it up, and if you're able to stay, we have probably other folks can make some comments, but I do want to thank you for your participation today, and we'll continue our conversation tomorrow as well. But feel free to kind of hang out a little bit, and we can have a few more comments and stuff before we go to the proclamations.